Hi, this is Catherine Perbanazoff. I'm one of the producers for Let's Travel. Today my guest is Andrew Berman, who is the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. So Andrew, let's start right away. What is it that you do?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. As you said, I'm the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. We're a nonprofit, community-based organization that's been around since 1980. We're the largest membership organization in Greenwich Village, the East Village, and NoHo. And we work to document and celebrate and protect the special architectural and cultural heritage of those neighborhoods. And we do that through everything from children's education programs, lectures, walking tours, symposia, a great deal of research and documentation that we do on the buildings and the built form in our neighborhood. And, of course, a lot of advocacy work, pushing the city to extend landmark protections where appropriate in the neighborhood, pushing for appropriate zoning regulations that help protect and reinforce neighborhood character, pushing back against inappropriate or bad development proposals, and working to preserve small businesses and cultural institutions in the neighborhood.
Okay. You have a program that deals specifically with school children. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Our Kids Ed program is the first of its kind in New York City. It's the first one that was geared towards children in terms of teaching about historic preservation. And the way that it does that is it basically uses our neighborhood as sort of a living classroom. Children from schools from all over the city and locally come down to the village as part of this program. It's a three-session program. Starts off first in the classroom. Then they come and they walk around certain parts of the neighborhood and look at the built forms around them. And the teachers show them how they can learn things about how our society has evolved, how technology has evolved, how immigration took place, just by looking at the buildings around them. For instance, showing them that buildings built up until a certain point in time were no more than four or five or maybe six stories because there was no such thing as an elevator. And so the height of a building was limited by how high people were willing to climb stairs. But then with the invention of the elevator, you started to get taller buildings. They take them around and show them areas that housed the waves of immigrants that came to the city at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century and how they transformed the neighborhood. They show them pictures of what the neighborhood looked like before things that were there now and compared to what they look like now so they can see how it went from farm to small town to city. So it's really it's a great experience. We have many, many schools who do it over and over again, and we have many schools each year and each semester, new ones coming in from Staten Island, the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn. And if you're interested in finding out more, just go to our website, www.gvshp.org, and click on education, and you can find out how to sign up your class.
Sounds great. Sounds like we should all take it. Do the children also come back and say, you know, I mentioned this to my parents, or I'm getting my parents involved? Mm-hmm. How do you think it's really affecting them?
Well, in a few ways. Hopefully it's cultivating the next generation of New Yorkers who care about and appreciate the built environment around them. Certainly we do see interactions between the children and their parents around the issues that are brought up. I mean, in some cases, some of these classes have parents as classroom helpers, so sometimes they actually participate. But I do think it opens up a dialogue. And the hope is not simply that the child says, wow, you know, that area around Washington Square Park is really cool, but that they can then also go back to their own community and start looking at and understanding the built environment around them better and appreciating it as well. The village and the East Village and NoHo just happen to be such great living examples of that, that it's so easy to learn from it. But those lessons can be taken anywhere.
What kind of questions do the children usually ask?
As children are wont to do, there's a whole range of questions. You know, they're often very, very curious about what life was like way back when things were so different. You know, what was life like for school children like them at that time? What did people do without conveniences that were that are we take for granted now? But oftentimes they also want to know, well, gee, why was that beautiful old house knocked down to make way for that ugly NYU dorm? And, you know, why do we let that happen? Those are questions that come up a lot from the kids as well.
And how do we answer that?
Well, it depends on the situation. But often we tell them how these decisions are made by our city leaders. And sometimes the city leaders, we think, listen and weigh the issues equitably. But sometimes the big and powerful have more pull than the rest of us and get their way. And that's an important lesson to know and to understand how that can be counteracted. And, of course, that's a lot of what we do as well.
One thing that I've been curious about for a long time, it's like, how does one, either as an individual or as a member of a group like yours, you know, fight these things or defend themselves as best they can, given that the powers that be usually have a lot of power by definition mm-hmm. and a lot of money? Mm-hmm. You know, could you give us some examples how the average guy or the average gal can fight
make a difference.
This.
Sure.
Make a difference. Not necessarily fight, but make a difference.
Yeah. Well, you know, we, I think, have a very strong track record. We've had many, many successes, both in terms of fighting against bad things and fighting for and securing good things for the neighborhood. So, you know, fortunately, we're able to say you can win. You don't always. The most important thing to remember is, you know, oftentimes we are up against people or institutions with much greater resources than we have. I mean, we're a small community organization with a budget of roughly $500,000 a year. I'm not complaining, but that's, you know, that's nothing compared to what these guys have to spend in a day. You know, we do live in a democracy, which is imperfect, but the thing that we have to sort of counterbalance against their money and influence is people power. And we certainly try to use that. We try to make it as easy as possible for people to understand how the system works, how the public review and approval processes work for these various projects that are coming up, and how they can have their voice be heard in the process, who needs to hear it, what's the basis or the criteria for the decision. You know, I've been working in this field for 20 years, and I'm still constantly learning because the laws and rules and regulations and just the practices are so arcane and so complicated. It almost seems to be purposely structured to make it impenetrable to the average person. So we try to do as much as possible to make it understandable so that people know if they say, you know what, I'm upset about this, or I think this is great, that's an important thing to feel. But if you don't know how to apply that to the system that's going to decide what happens, then it's, you know, it's the tree falling in the woods that nobody hears. So we try to make sure that people know how they can do it. And we do that even for things where we don't necessarily have a position on it, but we just want to give people access to the system and know how they can make their voices heard. And it does make a difference. You know, people have been very surprised about things that we've been able to both stop and bring about. That everybody said, oh, you know, you're crazy, you're tilting at windmills. But in some cases, we've succeeded, and we're very proud of that.
Yeah, a lot of the laws also are based on the 18th century, the 17th century, which are not really relevant today, which also brings me to, given that media has changed so much with the internet, how has that affected what you do, either help you or hinder you or just sort of be neutral?
Mm-hmm. Well, we try as much as possible to take advantage of the new medium and the new ways of communicating. One of the things we're most famous for is our emails, where we try to be very good about keeping people informed and letting them know how they can find out more and how they can be involved. We have an email list of about 10,000 people, 10,000 unique addresses, so it's actually more than 10,000 people, which is a really useful tool. And if you're interested in getting on our email list, again, just go to our website, shp.gv, as in village, shp.org, and you can click a button and get put on our email list. We have been utilizing social media. We have a Facebook page, we Twitter, we have a blog now, which allows us to provide additional information to people. We have a very, very extensive website with tons and tons and tons of information on it so that people can find out more and to kind of illustrate these issues. You know, for instance, you say to people, NYU is planning on adding 3 million square feet to the neighborhood. You know, the average person doesn't necessarily know what 3 million square feet means. So in order to be able to kind of illustrate that and break it down for them, I think is really important. For instance, saying, well, that's more than the Empire State Building. And here's where they want to put it, and here's what it would look like. And the new medium gives us an opportunity to do that and do that very quickly with people. You know, in the old days, if you wanted to let people know about some meeting that was coming up, you could organize a phone bank and hope that you had everybody's phone numbers, or you could try to put together a mailing and you had to get it to the post office 2.5 weeks in advance. You know, now in about 5 minutes, we can shoot out an email directly to people.
It's also a lot cheaper than doing like a brochure and sending it out and hoping that people get it, et cetera.
More environmentally friendly. So we certainly take advantage of that, though we do, you know, publish a twice yearly newsletter and an annual report for, you know, people who enjoy the satisfaction of an actual object
hard
in their
copy
hands that they can read. I'm that way myself. Every once in a while on the weekend, I actually pick up and read the New York Times, and I'm like, wow, this is so different than just reading it online every day. But so we do take full advantage of the new medium.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about, you know, antiquated laws. Have you found some law firms doing a lot of pro bono work for you, or a certain amount of pro bono work? Have you found some law firms that, let's say, are very, very involved with land real estate developers, very anti you? If you want, you can name names.
Sure. It's interesting. I mean, first of all, we've had to become sort of our own amateur legal team. A lot of this stuff, I think people are intimidated by the legal aspects of it. And there are certain things that you can only do with a lawyer. But much of it, we've taken on cases before the Board of Standards and Appeals without the benefit of a lawyer. And in some cases, we've won. We have had some firms that have given us pro bono service, which is great. The organization does have a policy that we don't engage directly in litigation, so we never sue anybody. Mm-hmm. That's certainly a tool and a very useful sometimes tool out there. And typically what will happen is we'll ally ourselves with perhaps another organization or entity which is doing that, and we might provide support but not be the actual plaintiff per se in the case. But so that's definitely one set of tools out there. And in terms of law firms out there, I mean, it's funny, you know, so there's certainly firms that represent the big developers and institutions who we've been on opposite sides of the table with. Funnily enough, every once in a while, you end up on the same side of the table with them. I'm sure a lot of them, we're not their favorite group out there, but, you know, that's okay. That means we're doing our job.
Yeah, as long as they don't physically threaten you, we all have our different opinions. How did you get into this field?
Basically two ways. I mean, first of all, I'm a lifelong New Yorker, and this has always been a sort of a love and passion of mine. My parents are New Yorkers as well. My father grew up in Brooklyn. My mother grew up in the Bronx. We always had tons of stories growing up about, you know, sort of what things were like, what the city was like, what their neighborhoods were like then. My mother's family was displaced by Robert Moses for the construction of the Cross Bronx Expressway. So for that reason, among others, I think I always grew up with this sort of sense of appreciation and understanding of how the city evolves and changes, and how done poorly it can have such a detrimental impact, but how done right it can be so beneficial and something that, you know, people will, you know, have such wonderful and fond memories of years later. I studied architectural history in college, but got more focused on politics. And then when I got out of school, I ended up working for an elected official who represents the west side of Manhattan for many years. I started off as his Greenwich Village community liaison and worked up to being his chief of staff, both in the city council and then in the state senate, where I did do a lot of work on land use and landmarking issues. When it was time for me to move on from there, I loved working in government and politics because so many different issues intersect there. But to a certain degree, I felt as though my kind of creative side wasn't being nurtured as much as I would like it to be. So when the executive director position came open for GVSHP, it seemed like the sort of perfect marriage of my different areas of interest. You know, on the one hand, so much of what's involved there is, you know, sort of policy issue, community organizing, politics, et cetera. But at the same time, there's sort of a more direct connection to us kind of love and appreciation for the arts, architecture, the city. So that was at the end of this year. That'll be 10 years ago.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
You mentioned how cities change, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. One city that I'm rather familiar with is Paris. And the whole thing with Haussmann when he did his great plan was there were all these little tiny streets, little tiny alleys, and it was very easy to set up a barricade. So when you had these huge boulevards, the Champs-Élysées, et cetera, it's very hard to set up. So I'm not saying that was the only reason he did it. Mm-hmm. But again, it's how it influenced also a lot of the roads, et cetera, were for military use. And again, our interstate highway, which was, you know, done under Eisenhower, was done so that if we were attacked by Russia, you know, the trucks and the vans and the cars could move around. So again, you have to really go in depth to figure out why, you know, a city is built the way it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all have like pet peeves, things that drive us a little nuts or greatly nut. What really upsets you about what is happening in preservation?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think the biggest thing that upsets me is how too often the opponents of preservation are successful at putting quote-unquote preservation in sort of this box as if it's this very sort of esoteric cause that really only affects a very, very small number of kind of an elite few for whom it's this kind of hobby. When in fact the real issues of preservation affect everybody in one form or another, and really what it's about is making our city as livable as possible, nurturing the aspects of it that we love and hold dear. And, you know, it can be different for everybody. I mean, even among the kind of conventional orthodox preservationists, you know, what one person might consider a great monument or a great building, another might not. And that's fine. There is certainly an element of subjectivity to this, although we certainly think that, you know, things that are older and represent an era that is no longer here and which once gone can never be returned certainly deserve a special consideration in our city. And as our city does change so much over time, it really is important that we hold on to what makes it so distinctive and what makes it so unique. I find it very frustrating when it feels as though people in charge of our city seem to be trying to make New York as good as Dubai or Hong Kong or what have you, and sort of almost keeping up with the Joneses. Obviously, it's extremely important that we have economic development here and that the city continue to grow. But I think we want New York to grow and thrive in a way that reflects what's great about it and not about it trying to be as good as sort of the new kid on the block.
Yeah, because we're not the new kid on the block. We're right. New York. Also, what I find very disconcerting about what you're saying, it's, you know, they try to put a little box. Well, this is very esoteric. It has nothing to do with anything. And that people buy that and they don't really see the issues. Like so many small businesses have been forced out, have been pushed out.
Right.
So many people who live in buildings have been forced out.
That's right.
For these super duper condos for the very, 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 very rich. And what about the people who make a city what it is? I mean, I've read many articles, I'm sure we all have, about many artists cannot come to New York, whether they be painters, dancers, whatever. It's too expensive. And if they're already here, they have to, you know, they have to leave because they just cannot afford it. Mm-hmm. What are some of the changes that are happening in preservation, and where do you see, let's say, the future of preservation, let's say 5-10 years from now?
Well, you know, among other things, I think it's really important that we drive home the point that preservation is, in fact, economic development, because cultural tourism is huge. People come to New York and to other cities to see places and experience environments that are unique, that they can't find or experience everywhere else, that have some connection to a cultural heritage or history that they're interested in. I mean, if you look at so many of the great tourist destinations throughout New York, throughout the country, rather, and New York being prime among them, so often it is about exactly that, whether it's Boston, you know, where people want to go on the Freedom Trail, or New Orleans to see the French Quarter, or San Francisco to see the Victorians. That is an enormously important part of what people come to New York for as visitors. And the, you know, the mayor, I think rightfully so, has an emphasis on tourism, that it's important that we attract and bring tourists here. But let's understand, you know, tourists don't come to say, oh, I want to see that great new 40-story office building that looks just like the one in my hometown. They come here because they want to see the things that make New York different.
New York.
Yeah, that make New York, New York, and make New York different. The other thing that I think is really important for the where preservation is going, hopefully is going, is the understanding that preservation is green. And oftentimes, especially, try to make it seem as though reusing old buildings is incompatible with being the most green and environmentally sensitive and effective that you can, when exactly the opposite is true. First of all, it's much, much easier to retrofit old buildings than a lot of these folks make it out to be.
And may I add, many of the old buildings were really very well built. I mean,
yes,
they were built forever.
Right. That is very true. There's a certain permanence to a lot of them that you don't see in a lot of new construction. But, and most importantly, reusing those materials rather than demolishing them. First of all, demolition has an enormous amount of environmental impact. There's a lot of work and energy that goes into it. There's a lot of potential pollution and contamination and things like that that can take place. And then you have to bring in all new materials to construct anew. If you are able, and I'm not saying that in every single case this is the way that it can be done, but if you are able to, in fact, reuse what's there, that is clearly the environmental perspective as well as the economic development perspective. There are tremendous benefits to historic preservation, and that's something that we really have to put at the forefront of our movement as we try to convince the public and the powers that be how important it is to emphasize preservation.
This also comes back a little bit to media. You're saying, you know, this is an economic asset. This is an environmental asset. Do you find that the media, which includes radio, television, cable, what have you, do you find that they're pretty savvy about some of the issues? Do you think that when they report something, it's somewhat balanced, like the pros and the cons? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the media? Do you feel that they need more education?
You know, it really depends. It depends on the reporter. It depends on the outlet. And some are very business-oriented. Some are just reflexively.
Yeah, but it's good business. That's just the whole thing. This is good business.
Right. Well, some of them are, I think, are reflectively oriented towards new development, that they think that that is sort of the key to the future. I think, as with anything, something that I've come to appreciate about reporters over the years is that, you know, in like an hour, they have to become expert on a topic that maybe they've had no exposure to before, and write both a compelling and hopefully accurate article about it. That's no easy task. So to a certain degree, I think the responsibility falls upon us as advocates or educators or what have you to do a good job of clearly and simply conveying to these folks what we see the issues as and providing the backup to tell that story. And one of the things that I think that the preservation movement and just, you know, advocates for neighborhoods who in many cases are not professionals but just average folks fighting to protect what they really believe in don't necessarily have the same level of expertise in that area that our opponents do. You know, when we're fighting NYU, for instance, they have this incredibly highly paid PR staff that, you know, knows how to spin a story and make something that's really about one thing to reframe it and make it sound as though it's about something else. So we have to do our homework to make sure we're as good at framing the story and telling the story as the other side, if not better. I do think that sometimes some in the media have their prejudices against what we're trying to do. There are some who I think are very favorable to the kind of work that we do. So it really depends. You know, sometimes just getting the word out there about what you're doing, even if it's not necessarily portrayed in the most 100% accurate or favorable light, can still be helpful because it lets people who do understand the issue and who are sympathetic to you know that you're doing this and allows you to sort of connect with them. But obviously, ultimately, you do want to have your issues conveyed fairly and accurately, and that's just an ongoing effort to make that happen.
Yeah, I recently read an article about where I live, and it was in the New York Times, and there were some things that were totally off.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a journalist is not necessarily an expert, and you mentioned they have an hour. Sometimes they don't even have an hour, so they just sort of slap it together.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's sometimes it's whoever speaks the loudest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they listen, or the quickest, or whatever. So, I mean, that is a problem. But then again, so much of our lives are based on what the media says, whether it's, you know, true or not.
Mm-hmm.
We just sort of, you know, take it for granted. Well, CBS News said this, so it must be correct.
Yeah.
Or the New York Times said this, it must be correct. As opposed to, and that's also one of the problems with media, is that they're based, you know, on advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
So if, you know, they have a lot of real estate developers putting in ads, you know, maybe they have to sort of lean that way because, you know, who pays for your dinner tonight?
Right. And you do see that a lot, especially with local media, that the any sort of institution or business interest that has something going on in that area, they will try to leverage good coverage by advertising heavily in that local media.
Yeah,
That's obviously not something that we or others have the ability to counteract in that way. We have to counteract it in other ways. And, you know, I always tell people, look, things are going to be stacked against you in so many of these ways, and you can spend all your time complaining or haranguing about that. And it's important to point it out, but you can't be discouraged by it. You have to say, okay, that's what they have. Let me look at what I have and what I can do. You know, most of these papers allow you the opportunity to submit op-eds and things like that. That's important to do. Letters to the editor. You can stage press events, demonstrations, things like that will draw the coverage. And you can let them know who their readership is and what it is that their readership wants, because ultimately the ad revenue is only useful to them if they maintain their readership. And if they know that their readership is not liking the direction that they're going in, that will affect them as well.
Yeah, again, it's like, this is what I have going for me and this is what I have going against me, and how do I work with that? When you're meeting with an opponent, do you try to find out as much as you can about that opponent?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, it depends on the situation. Oftentimes, they're trying to find out as much as they can
Absolutely.
About us as well. You know, sometimes, and because we do often meet with developers or other entities that we're going to ultimately disagree with, we try, if at all possible, to disagree agreeably. Sometimes that
can
doesn't
we agree
always work
to disagree?
So well. Right. Exactly. Sometimes, like when it's Donald Trump, there is no agreeable disagreement. Yeah, you know, I mean, among other things, you're trying to find out more about what they're planning, what they're doing, to see if there's a way in which you can find something that is that they can live with or that fulfills their needs that you think would make things better. And, you know, there are certainly some developers who come to the table in an honest, open way, and where we've seen them make changes. Typically, it's because it either ultimately seemed to be in their economic self-interest or because they knew it would get them through the regulatory process more easily. You know, sometimes there's a genuine, I think, interest in good design or in maintaining a good relationship with the community. But other times it's, you know, that isn't there. And really what it's going to end up being a knockdown, drag out fight. And we've done those as well. That's always a last resort, but it works that way sometimes.
Yeah, if it comes to that, it comes to that. I mean, one of my things about New York University, NYU, or as it's also known, the Evil Empire, let alone what they're doing to the environment, let alone what they're doing to the community. But a lot of their buildings are really ugly, whether they fit in or not. I mean, that was the whole thing with the Frank Gehry building, IAC. A lot of people said it didn't fit in. I personally love it. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of the NYU buildings are ugly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine who majored in art history at New York University, she believes it's because they don't have a school for architecture. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more than that, because I don't think you have to go to architectural school to have something that's, you know, viable. When you travel, do you try to find, you know, this sort of the historic preservation in another city to compare it, to analyze it? Mm-hmm. Or do you just sort of walk around and say, I'm just walking around?
No, I mean, you know, that part of me never really gets turned off. And it's definitely a big part of what I just find interesting. You know, I often say I'm so lucky because the job that I get to do is what I would probably be doing in my spare time if I had a different kind of job. But instead of it being my sort of side work, it gets to actually be my profession, which is great. So things like this I find interesting and I love and I care about. And yes, when I travel, I do – one of the things that I'm very interested to see is in other cities and other places, how do they preserve things? What kind of a job do they do with that? I'm also really interested to see how do they – add to it or build upon it, because I find that in New York we have difficulty building in a way that's respectful of our history often, more so in some cases than others, and it's a challenge to do. There's other cities that I've seen that have done it in what I think are really great ways. And then
name a few cities that you think have get an A+ or something like that.
Well, you know, rather than sort of giving the whole city a grade, I'll say, you know, I've been very impressed in Miami, in the Deco District, that in some cases at least, A, they've managed to preserve aspects of the buildings that we see lost over time, the industrial casement windows and things like that, which all too frequently we either get rid of or replace with horrible sort of modern non-equivalents. And in some cases, not in every case, I think some of the new development has been very respectful of the environment down there. You know, it's interesting, in Europe, you see a different combination of things. There are definitely cases where there's new development in historic areas that's sort of respectful in scale but very modern in sensibilities. And then there's different kinds of approaches, which is, okay, we're going to not touch the historic areas. We're just going to sort of build almost entirely from scratch on the outside, like a La Défense, mm-hmm. Outside of Paris. So there's, you know, some interesting and different approaches that you see in Europe as well, which I think that there's things that we can learn from there, both in terms of mistakes and in terms of things that are done really well. And in general, when I travel, I look to see what's new as well and how are new things being done elsewhere. You know, unfortunately, New York has struggled, not always, but for a long time now, where our new architecture and development is not, for the most part, there are exceptions, very inspiring compared to a lot of other places. And that's one of the reasons why I think there's so many misgivings in our city about new development and why people are so eager to preserve what they have, because they know that what's going to replace it is going to be so much worse,
yeah,
by comparison. And I think if the level of new design were better, it could both be more respectful of the historic stuff that we should be keeping, and I think people would be more open to it as well.
Yeah. Again, your group is Historic Preservation. What defines that? Is it sort of like the 19th century, the 18th century? How do you define historic?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, history is anything that's in the past.
Right.
And the recent past is often just as interesting, in some ways even more so, than the more distant past. Obviously, the more distant past is very important in the village, at least, you know, relatively speaking, in a young country like America and a relatively young city like New York, is one of the oldest parts of the city with some of its most important architectural artifacts. But, you know, we certainly embrace and are open to the recent past as well. Modern and modernism, you know, kind of post-war, mid-century modern. You know, we pushed to get the IMPEI Silver Towers landmarked successfully. We are very happy recently when the state of New York's Office of Historic Preservation deemed the design for Washington Square Village eligible for the State National Register of Historic Places, which NYU wants to destroy with its new development plans. And, you know, we're not exclusively about the built environment. We're about the cultural environment as well. And GVSHP has done a lot of work around our neighborhood's recent cultural history, you know, the last generation or two, you know, whether it's the Beats and the hippies or, you know, sort of the 80s in the East Village with the, you know, the arts movements there, the lesbian and gay civil rights movement, all of which are, you know, so deeply woven into our neighborhood's history. What's interesting with the more recent past is you get into what sometimes we refer to as contested history, meaning that it's things where, you know, the book hasn't really been fully written and closed on it. And that makes it in some ways harder to both have that conversation and to be able to definitively say, well, this is what it means and this is what it was. But in a lot of ways, I think it makes it more interesting as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, meanings also change. Like when I was in high school and college, we were taught that, like, the Spaniards blew up the Maine. Right. And now the theory is that it was cold bin dust that caused the explosion, and who knows, maybe next year it'll be something else. This is something also that I feel strongly about and that I don't like, and I would say a la Disney. Sometimes, you know, when they do one of their projects, you know, whether it be Disney World or Disneyland, it's very what I call cutesy. It's very artificial. It's very much like, what is it? It's been called the architecture of comfort, because it's not threatening, it's not ethnic, it's not global. What are some of your feelings about that? Though some of that now is historic.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That's a debate that sort of, I think, kind of rages on in the preservation world, which is when you're building in a way that's supposed to connect to or relate to something historic, do you just imitate it and make no reference to the fact that it's actually in the present? Or do you try to do something contemporary but respectful? Generally speaking, I think contemporary but respectful is the better way to go, although I wouldn't say that I think that you should never try to imitate the past in terms of weaving something new together with something old. But I do think you run the risk of something that's sort of cutesy or precious or that ultimately feels really fake. And that's not a great way of kind of building or growing our historic neighborhoods and keeping that character. You know, it's one of those indefinable things. You know, sometimes you, and it's also something that I think everybody sees differently. You know, sometimes you see a new building that might be, you know, completely modern, you know, all glass or something like that, but it's done in a way that's really respectful, deferential, whether it's the scale, whether it's the kind of the material, is it this sort of very kind of like harsh reflective glass, or is it sort of very elegant and clear? And, you know, sometimes you can see a building that uses the traditional materials, you know, brick and stone, and it can just be ugly because it's just not done well.
Yeah, it's just ugly.
you know, so, and I think it's important to remember that there's no simple formulas. And, you know, sometimes people will use that against us and say, well, you know, you're trying to put all these rules in place and that stifles creativity and blah, blah, blah. And it's true that, you know, rules do, they do place restrictions on you. But ultimately, those should be looked at as positive challenges. You know, you never build without some sort of rule, whether the rule is how much money you can spend, what sort of materials are available, what the program is for the building, et cetera, or sort of more modern kind of regulations of it can only be this high, or you have to set back here, or you have to get approval from the Landmarks Preservation Commission to make it look a certain way. But, you know, even with historic districts, it's not like once something is designated a historic district, you can never build something new, or you can never build modern materials. You just have to convince this board that what you're doing is respectful of what's around it. So, and the commission, actually the current commission, I would say, is quite embracing of modern design. In some cases, we think they've gone a little too far. One example is that curving glass building on the corner of 13th Street and 8th Avenue, which the Landmarks Preservation Commission approved, which we thought was not appropriate for the Greenwich Village Historic District. We didn't think it really made a particular effort to relate to the character around it. And we said right up front, now this was a parking lot, so something was going to get built there, and we were fine with that. And we were not saying, well, you know, it's got to be all brick and cutesy and look like an old, you know, federal row house or something like that. That, you know, we said it's perfectly fine to consider modern materials here, but we want to see something that shows that in some way it says, I recognize that I'm in Greenwich Village, I recognize that there's a historic district around me, and even though I'm new, I'm relating to that. And unfortunately with that building, I just don't see that.
Right, we're sort of kissing cousins, even though we're different, but we're kissing cousins. It's also interesting because that building is next to, I guess it's a power station, a substation, mm-hmm. Right. Which is very Art Deco.
Right.
So I agree with you, it doesn't fit in at all. There's one trend that's been going on for a number of years, which I find very disconcerting. For example, the High Line is 70% funded privately. Mm-hmm. This Central Park is also very heavily funded in private sources. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have the money, it's great. But if you don't, like, and again, all these business improvement districts, mm-hmm. like the Lower East Side, I think their budget is $50,000. Wall Street is how many millions? Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a trend. It's not a trend yet in France. That doesn't mean they won't pick up our bad habits. But I think that's a very disconcerting, because in other words, if you have the money, you can do certain things. And if you don't have the money, you can't. And yet, do you think that trend, especially because the economy is not only going to continue, but it's going to grow? What's your feeling about this trend?
You do certainly see it as a growing trend in a lot of different ways. You know, and there are now things that are being looked at. We have, as you said, these business improvement districts. They're looking at things like park improvement districts. That would be these sort
and of also semi- schools.
Right. That's right. And, you know, now more and more we're relying on developers and private institutions to build our public schools, which I find mind-boggling. You know, I think that there's a variety of issues there. And, you know, sometimes I think it's more appropriate. Sometimes I think it's less appropriate. I do think that, generally speaking, it's reflective of a very problematic trend, which is a disinvestment in public infrastructure. If we were investing adequately enough in our parks, in keeping our streets clean, in building schools as they are needed, we wouldn't have to turn to these alternatives. And we wouldn't be put in these terrible rock and hard place sort of positions where, you know, if we want Central Park to look as beautiful as it does, and I think we all do, it requires an enormous amount of money and care. And that's not the same level of investment that can be at this point given to every park in New York City. So that's why they've turned to this sort of private level of support for doing it. And I think that, you know, no matter what the situation is, the amount of support that something like Central Park gets, there's always going to be a little extra from the outside. But because we're not investing enough in parks, because we're not investing enough in taking care of them and in creating new ones as needed, it's put us in this position where we have to say, well, you know, if you want Central Park to look as good as it does, we can either take it away from other parks in the city, or you have to go outside of the public system in order to get the support for it. And that's a really bad dichotomy that we've set up, I think.
Yeah, it's very bad. It's almost like saying, okay, you know, the government's not going to do it, and actually we're going to do less and less. So if you don't do it, it's really going to get bad. And I think a lot of people wrongly are accepting that because basically, I mean, I know with some of the bids, especially the one on the Lower East Side, this was several years ago, they were starting, and I think they all do, they were starting to do city services like sanitation, protection, et cetera. So the government says, well, you're doing it, so I don't have to do it. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
You know, it just doesn't seem to me like a win-win. All right, so if you want a little extra whipped cream, you know, the private or the nonprofit, you know, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's the thing of like, well, why are we paying taxes mm-hmm. if it's not going there?
Yeah, I mean, another perfect example of that, well, you brought it up before, is the public schools. You know, in the neighborhoods downtown, there's a terrible shortage of space in the public schools, partly because of all of the development that the city has fostered in those areas. So there's a lot of new people going in there, and some of them send their kids to public school, as well they should. You know, we want them to do that. But now they're at, you know, 120% capacity or more, or like there simply isn't room to send them to their local public schools. And even when people have really rallied and pushed to get new public school spaces added, the city has not done it. And what they've done is seemingly they've held back and waited for NYU or Trinity Real Estate, who are coming forward with these development and rezoning proposals, to include public schools in their proposals so that they could say, well, you know, if you let us build this, we'll include a school. Yeah. And, I think that's bad enough. But what's worse is that it looks as though the city has actually held back in order to let them do that, even though it will take many years longer. And so for years and years and years, the neighborhood is going with this really, I think, untenable overcrowding situation. So, you know, we definitely see this in some cases reflected in, I think, really bad ways. And there seems to be almost a collusion between government and the private entities about giving the responsibility over to them and allowing them to do things that the public or the community would not normally even be open to.
Right, and also a kid may very well go through all his schooling or her schooling until the actual school is built.
Right.
I'd like to discuss also a little bit about, you know, multifaceted society. You deal with the federal level, the state level, and the local level. Mm-hmm. What are some of the differences and some of the similarities? Mm-hmm. And when they all get together, is it like a free-for-all, or is there some logic?
Mm-hmm. Well, we most frequently deal with the local level, but we do deal with state and federal. And, you know, it's a funny thing when it comes to preservation and even in general with land use. The higher level of government actually typically has less power and less control, and it's actually the lower level of government. So, for instance, if you get something landmarked by the city of New York, there is a very strict set of controls that are then placed on it. Whereas if something is the equivalent of landmarked, which is placement on the state or national register of historic places, or in some cases there is something called a national historic landmark, by the state or federal government, the controls are actually much, much, much weaker.
It's funny. I would have thought just the opposite.
Yeah. No, most people do. And yeah. Logically, in most cases, you know, obviously federal law trumps state law, law trumps local law. But with preservation and land use issues, it's generally just about the exact opposite. If there's a building that you want to see saved and preserved in perpetuity, you need to get it landmarked by the city of New York. If you get the federal government or the state government to recognize it in that way, it can possibly help, but generally speaking, they can still demolish it if they choose to. It's mostly incentives that are offered. The only conditions under which it becomes sort of definitive, where they can say, no, you can't, is if it's a state or federal action that's involved. So if the arm of the state or federal government landmarks a property, another state agency might be prevented or federal agency from demolishing it, but not a private owner, which in 99% of the cases is what you're up against.
Yeah. One thing also, like with the National Registry, they never say why. They say it's deemed or it's noted as being of importance, but they don't say why. And regarding that, in Vinegar Hill, which is in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. There was a 19th century church that was landmarked by the federal government, and it was torn down by the owner. In this case, the owner was a religious group. It was Jehovah's Witnesses, and they took down the whole block. And mm-hmm. part of the problem was that there was nobody speaking up mm-hmm. saying, don't do this. But part of the problem is they just did it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with I mean, I don't want to get into a Freudian thing or analysis, but when you lose something, in other words, when you lose a battle, how do you deal with it? How do you sort of process it with you and your staff and, you know, other members that have been, you know, involved in this?
Sure. Well, it comes up. It comes up a fair amount. You know, I'd say two things. One is it's really important for us to always remember we are going to lose some, but we do win quite a few as well, and not to be discouraged. Usually we try to do as good a job as possible of documenting what happened there. And oftentimes we will fight to the bitter end and make sure that the public and the powers that be are as aware as possible of the opposition to what has happened so that next time that something like this comes up, they understand and get what a stink and fuss there will be. So in the hopes that something good will come out of that mistake or that tragedy so that hopefully they'll say, oh, God, it's those people
again.
We're
going to see them again. Oh, God.
I don't want another one of what happened last time in terms of the, you know, the response. So, you know, and I'll admit that there are sites and buildings that we've lost that it's been painful because, you know, they've had such character. They've had – and people have been so attached to them. One of the ones that I – most often think about is actually something not too far from here, the old tunnel garage, which was on Thompson, which was this amazing. And what's most amazing about it is that when you first hear this, you can't believe that what was basically a parking garage is something that people would care so much
about.
But
it was a great design.
So beautiful. And one of the first purpose-built automobile parking garages in New York. It was in what most people would call high Art Deco before the term Art Deco even existed. It was built in 1922. What's amazing and a lot of people don't realize is it was called the Tunnel Garage and built basically in anticipation of the construction of the Holland Tunnel, which had not yet been built and which was when built years later at the end of the 1920s, was the first vehicular connection between Manhattan and New Jersey and the rest of North America. It was the longest tunnel in the world at the time that it was built. So it was this sort of modern marvel. So this automobile garage for this sort of newfangled device was quite rhapsodic in the way that it sort of kind of reflected this new technology that it was emerging and that it was serving. And, you know, of course, it had that beautiful multicolored terracotta medallion, this really striking lettering, this, you know, Art Deco ornament, these ribbon industrial casement windows. I mean, it was so beautiful. It was such an ode to the early automobile era. And the city just refused, in spite of ours and many others' protests, to step in and landmark the building. And it would have been a really worthy landmark. That one, you know, makes me sad because it was so special. We actually got preservation groups from Miami and Los Angeles and other places that are particularly interested in Art Deco architecture to write to the Landmarks Preservation Commission and say, you know, we wish we had this building in our city. It's beautiful. You should preserve it. But unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears.
I was very upset when they tore it down. What is there now? I'm blocking on it entirely. What did they put up there?
A new condo. And you know, one of the sort of tragic ironies is we pushed very hard to get that beautiful multicolored terracotta medallion, which had this image of a car. At first, we thought it was a Model T. It turns out it's more likely a Model A, emerging from the not yet built Holland Tunnel. It was just such a cool image that was on the rounded corner of the building. We wanted it preserved. We wanted it saved. And there is a little park across the street, and we thought it would be great if it could be mounted and placed in there as sort of a memorial. Well, the developer did agree to preserve it, but what they did was they stuck it on the very, very top of the building where
nobody's going to see it.
Well, it can barely be seen unless you're standing far away, and because it was on the curved corner of the building, they stuck it on a flat surface. So what they did was the many pieces of it were sort of split and flattened out, so there's all this white space in between them because it's no longer hugging the curve. So, you know, it's sort of like if you peel an orange and you flatten it out, it's no longer an elegant circle. It's the sort of weird pieces.
They know what they do. I mean, they just don't know. I mean, it's like they don't know that they don't know, and that's the sad part. Yeah, I was very sad when they threatened it, and then when they actually did it, and I haven't walked down there, and I guess I don't want to see what they've done, especially now that I hear what they've done.
You almost sound like Jesus. They know not what they do.
Yeah, well, no, it's true. I mean, they know not what they do. Do you also converse with other groups? Do they ask for your advice, and do you ask for their advice?
Absolutely.
Could you give some examples?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, we... for instance, just recently a group up in Inwood in Upper Manhattan reached out to us to say we're embarking on our own, you know, sort of preservation campaign. We'd love to talk to you about what you've done and what your successes have been. And then on the flip side of that, with this battle that's going on now with NYU and this huge plan that they have with this recent ruling that we got from the State Historic Preservation Office that I mentioned before about Washington Square Village being eligible for the State National Register of Historic Places. That's going to impact NYU's plans because they want to use state funds. And so, as per what we were saying before, the use of state funds means that it now becomes subject to this review. And like I said, the state and federal review processes are not as rigid as the city ones are. So we reached out to some of our fellow preservation groups on the Upper West Side and elsewhere who've had experience with this use of state funds and state historic review process to say, how did it work for you? What worked? What didn't work? How did they manage to slip through the cracks or what have you? So it's definitely a two-way street. We turn to our fellow preservation groups for support and advice, and we also give it when it's asked of us.
Yeah, actually, in a way, it might be good that it's more on the state and federal level because maybe they're not as in bed with NYU or whatever the group is than, let's say, you know, and let's say the city. Mm-hmm. I mean,
let's hope so.
Yeah, who knows?
See.
Yeah, who knows where their hands, you know, reach. Is there anything that you would like to discuss or you wouldn't like to discuss?
Well, one thing that I'd love to mention is, you know, a big project of ours is our effort to get the South Village landmarked, which is the part of Greenwich Village south of Washington Square Park, which many people think of as the heart of the neighborhood, but which most people don't realize doesn't enjoy the same protections as the rest of the neighborhood. So, you know, McDougal Street, Sullivan Street, Bleecker Street, all south of Washington Square Park. Anything you see there could be demolished at any time and replaced with something miserably inappropriate. We proposed a South Village Historic District. The city did, in fact, accept the first third of it and designated it last year.
And congratulations.
Thank you. And that was the area between 6th and 7th Avenue, basically south of West 4th Street. So Carmine Street, Downing Street, Bedford Street, et cetera, which was a great, great, great victory. But after promising to move forward with the remaining two-thirds, basically the area between 6th Avenue and LaGuardia Place and extending south of Houston Street, they now seem to be backing away from that promise.
How come?
We don't know. Certainly it's the area that's adjacent to NYU's campus. I don't know if that might be part of it. You know, they won't say. They just suddenly say, well, we're looking at other things. We're doing other things. We're not sure what time we have for this. And aside from the fact that that neighborhood is immediately threatened, is undeniably historic, that there is incredible support for designation. It's somewhat infuriating that the city feels that it's okay to sort of make a promise to a community and then back away from it. And that's what I fear is happening.
Yeah, I mean, stick by your words. I mean, you said you were going to do this, you know, do it. And, yeah, I guess politics at work, economies at work?
We'll see. They can still do the right thing. The sad thing is that so many buildings have already been lost in that area. The Tunnel Garage, which we mentioned before, the Provincetown Playhouse and Apartments, Circle in the Square Theater, the Sullivan Street Playhouse, this wonderful 1860s row house at 178 Bleecker. And now we know that the Children's Aid Society buildings on Sullivan Street are threatened. And while landmarking can't prevent Children's Aid Society from selling their buildings and moving out of the neighborhood,
selling their air rights.
That's right. But landmark designation can make sure that the historic buildings are not torn down and that where there is new development, it is compatible with the neighborhood. And right now, under the current zoning, if anyone knows the Children's Aid Society, it's on Sullivan Street just north of Bleecker. It's four buildings altogether, so it's a big parcel. And they're selling them. A developer could come in and build a 15 or 20-story condo or dorm there very easily, and that would be tragic. And one of the main Children's Aid Society building was designed by Calvert Vaux, who is the architect of Central Park, the Jefferson Market Library, so one of the great American architects of the late 19th century. So that could be destroyed, and we could get some, you know, horrible thing
in
its place.
That not only is horrible, but doesn't fit in at all. How would somebody contact your group, and also how would somebody contact you specifically?
Sure. The easiest way, as always, is through our website, www.gvshp.org. So it's just the initials for Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. And just click on the Contact Us button. You can reach any of the staff members, including myself, directly through there, either by email or by phone. We're always happy to talk to you. We're always happy to get tips about things that you think are going on or things that you think need to be addressed, or answer questions. So don't hesitate
to
contact us.
Money is nice, and in kind is nice, and volunteering is nice.
Yes.
If somebody wants to do something, you're very receptive.
We are. We rely on the kindness of strangers and friends. We are, as I said, a nonprofit membership-based organization. So about 80% of our funding comes from just individual donations, and volunteers and interns do a tremendous amount of work of the organization.
Okay. We'll have you back so you can keep us apprised of what's going on or what's not going on, as the case may be.
I would love to.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.